Hey, everybody, it's Brad Williams and Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by White Cloud e-cigarettes.
We're not saying you should start smoking, but if you already do, awesome. And if you've ever wanted to try an e-cigarette, these are the ones to go with. White Cloud e-cigarettes offers over 20 flavors. That's almost as many as Baskin-Robbins. 20 flavors and 6 nicotine strengths. It's cheaper than other e-cigarettes that you'll see at convenience stores and with much more variety. White Cloud e-cigarettes... sponsors comedians. They've been doing it for over 2 years now. They've also sponsored comedy festivals like the Boston Comedy Festival and the Orlando Indie Comedy Festival. If you've ever been curious about trying an e-cigarette, I have. Well, the Fling is the low-cost, no-commitment way to do so. And the Fling offers same-day UPS shipping on orders before 6 p.m. Eastern.
But is there a website?
Customers can go to WCESigs.com. That's WCESigs.com.
But we want to make sure our listeners get them for cheap. So is there a coupon code?
To get 25% off of the order, use the coupon code ALNPODCAST. That's ALNPODCAST at WCESigs.com to get your White Cloud e-cigarettes today. And now enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray and Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast.
Hey, and I'm actually here for an intro.
Hey, thanks for showing up.
Oh, who knew? Well, I mean, we're sharing a hotel room in Omaha.
Yeah, we're also, you have to understand, the microphone in which we're recording on, it's just one singular mic that I use to do my Hyundai Sonata commercials from the road.
All right.
I can't turn it off. Everywhere I go, I'm like, I'd like a large Caesar salad with a side of fries.
It's really annoying.
But we have to be very close to this mic, so this is about as close as Brad and I's faces will ever get.
Unless you watch the YouTube video of us doing the What Does the Fox Say?
Oh, yes.
That was pretty close. Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, Mr. Adam, I got kind of lost in your eyes right there.
I know. Well, hey, you won't be the first dwarf to say that to me.
I need way more details once we shut that microphone off.
You're never going to hear. I was sworn to secrecy. Today's episode is really incredible. We definitely consider this guy one of the juggernauts in the stand-up comedy world.
Yeah.
He's opened a lot of doors for a lot of comics. He's helped a lot of comics. He's been at the top where very few have been, and he's also helped our own Brad Williams out more than I realized, as we got to find out. And I'm talking about
Carlos Mencia.
Yeah,
that's right. And many of you know that I was Mencia's opening act for 4 years. Went on the road with him. Pretty much pulled me from, literally pulled me out of
from a toy shop.
And wound me up, found the right, found the right D batteries, and just put me in the right direction. I was not a comedian, and as you'll hear, Mencia literally plucked me from the audience and started me on my road to stand up. So I owe a lot to the guy, and it's fascinating to hear his stories, his philosophies on stand up, and how he can really break down jokes into math. I understand that a lot of you guys will listen to this podcast and have your opinions on Carlos based on what you read on the internet or what you think. And listen, I can't change those, but I can just tell you to please listen to this podcast and
with an open mind.
Yeah, with an open mind, and just hear what he has to say, because it's fascinating stuff. And we do get into that a little bit. We talk about his reputation and how other comics may not have the most favorable opinions of him.
Yeah, but he talks really, and what was great about that is that he values both sides. He goes, I understand why people think what they think, and I am not shitting on that, and I also acknowledge what I did to maybe contribute to that way of thinking. And because it's always a two-way street, you know, like you said, like hearing his process, because you can't, you know, I don't know, man, you can't be that type of label, the shit that got slapped on him. For me, to see someone still have a loyal fan base, to still crush, to still come up with new material, to still be working the way he does, it just doesn't make sense to me to have, you know, the allegations that were thrown at him be...
Sure.
Be factual, and whether they are or not is not something I went to this podcast considering. I wanted to learn about a person that I am a fan of,
and respect. And hey, man, anyone who does stand up for 20 plus years and has a career that he's had and has gotten to have your own show and has helped out a buddy of mine. And as I said in the podcast, is the reason this podcast exists is because he started Brad on the path to comedy. And just a really intelligent human being, and that's always makes for a good podcast. And the stories he told, and like Brad said, the way he constructs and you know, looks at the way he crafts his jokes, and then some great road stories with Brad. Brad crying over girls in the tour buses.
Oh God! Yeah. I thought those stories were over. I thought that they just lived in the past, but no.
If you cry on a tour bus, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, please listen to this podcast while the theme song to the Wonder Years is playing in the background.
What would you do?
Oh God!
Of course, follow Carlos Mencia on Twitter at Carlos Mencia. Mm-hmm. Follow Brad on Twitter at Funny Brad. Follow me on Twitter at Adam Ray Comedy. Mencia's touring all the time, so check out his tour dates at carlosmencia.com. And, of course, follow me for my tour dates at adamraytv.com. I will be at the La Jolla Comedy Store April 10th and 11th in San Diego, California. Come out to those shows. Get your tickets at comedystore.com. And, of course, before that, next weekend, I'm going to be at the Shrine Auditorium next to Brad and I's alma mater, USC, for the April Foolishness Show.
Woo-hoo!
If you haven't gotten your tickets, you're fucked, because that show sold out in like 15 minutes.
StubHub.
Yeah, it was like Tickle Me Elmo of comedy shows. And the lineup is Gabriel Iglesias.
Wait, let me say it.
Wow, you said that like you were from Spain. Gabriel Iglesias is going to come serve us tapas with Pau Gasol.
And if you ask him to sign an autograph for you, ask him to do it with un lapiz.
Gabriel Iglesias, Adam Ray, Brad Williams, Eliza Schlesinger,
Ralphie May, Jay Moore.
Jay Moore. And closing, Tenacious D.
The D!
I mean, I can't even believe. I mean, all those guys, I can't believe I'm on the same lineup with. But Tenacious, it's like, you know, that's...
It's going to be an incredible night. We will 100% do a wrap-up podcast from there. So you will hear it. And more than likely, come up with start establishing some relationships and have many of those comics on this podcast.
Yeah, if we can get the D on, that'd be incredible.
Well, I mean, we know how you love the D.
I do love the D.
Someone please isolate that audio.
No, fuck you. I'm talking about Delta Burke. She was great on Designing Women. Fuck you. I respect women sitcoms.
Yeah. Come out and see me. Hartford, Connecticut, March 26th through the 29th. I'll be at the Funny Bone there. The aforementioned April Foolishness, the Shrine Auditorium, April 4th. Seattle, Adam Ray's hometown.
Yeah.
April 9th. I'm coming for one night only.
That's go see him.
One night only at the Downtown Parlor Club. And then Fort Worth, Texas, April 16th through the 18th, I'll be at Hyenas.
And while you're in Texas, visit your local Dallas Hyundai dealer and pick up a Hyundai Sonata.
God damn it.
That's
he does this all the time.
And of course, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Give it a 5-star rating. Comment on the podcast page. Tell your friends. Tell them to go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com. Tell them to go to astoymerchandise.com and pick up an ABL and t-shirt. We've got mugs and new shirts coming in the next week or so.
Right.
And I think these are going to be the game changers.
I mean, you know, if you enjoyed the movie Titanic, and who didn't?
Yeah.
You may love a certain photograph that me and my life partner
have posted
over here. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty damn.
It got more likes out of anything I think I've posted. Any joke, any video clip, any photo of my adorable nieces. This was the one. So get all that. Come see us live. Follow us on Twitter. Those are the tour dates. Those are the Twitter handles. That's all the merch info. And now, this intro coming to you live from the Hilton Garden Inn in Omaha, Nebraska, where Brad and I are doing this podcast intro from. Sit back and enjoy a very special, hilarious, and informative episode of the About Last Night podcast
with Carlos Mencia.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. No podcast, during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I haven't been out this way since Brad brought me to my first live porn shoot.
And of course that makes sense because, as you and I both know, being friends with Brad, one of the first things that happens when you become friends, he goes, "Hey, you know I know porn stars, right?"
I never got to be part of that.
Oh man, he even brought it to me. I was on my way to a Passover Seder at my aunt's house because she lives out here.
Yeah,
and so I was like, "Oh, well, it's on the way." That's the only reason I went.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what you want to do before you go into a Passover Seder. Is just be
it
like,
gave me a great like story in case conversation became stale at the table, which it does.
And like one of your childhood family members just like tries to give you a high five. You're like, maybe not that hand.
Yeah. Well, my aunt did immediately.
Brad was a virgin when I met him.
What?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
He was a virgin.
Yeah.
Brad not only was a virgin, but when I met Brad, I didn't even really even want to cater to this stupid conversation that he wanted to have with me, that he would never have sex or be in a relationship with a non-little person. That's who Brad was when I met him.
So yeah, this wow. is this
Brad Williams.
Complete,
this is your life.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. We're going through a complete flashback
wow.
right now.
Wait, yeah. So he said, "I don't want to have sex with little people."
Well, no, I
not only with little people.
I said only little people.
Jesus,
because
really?
Yeah. I was in a
How
relationship.
Dare you?
I know, right? How dare I?
I'm offended on behalf of all
well give
grown adults.
Well, give thanks to this guy.
Oh, you turned him on to
no, I just knew that it would
people.
Happen. It's inevitable. Come on now. Yeah. It was one of those things where it's like he, you know,
and now he
was very
enough.
Secure in his cocoon of life and. You know what I mean?
Which, by the way, that's what Brad does call his bed.
Yeah, yeah. Surrounded by yeah. nothing but safety and happy thoughts. You know what I mean?
And then,
he only did midget jokes at the time.
Yeah.
Even when I told him, dude, you could do jokes about relationships. He was like, I don't know, man. People just see me as a midget. And, all right, whatever. You know,
wow.
It's one of those things where
you
know that it's going to grow. You
yeah.
just kind of, yeah, you mentor these kids.
No pun intended. But the I think it's pretty, because I know how much you've influenced them, but that's, I didn't know the details of it. I mean, for you really, how much when you saw him when you guys first met, did you, and then also how does this go for you with just any young comic? Do you feel the desire to, you know, embark wisdom on them?
Yeah, the I am,
because it's free service from a professional. That's like,
yeah, but what happens is here's how it works. I find some young comic, you know, at a comedy club somewhere that I think is funny,
preferably a virgin,
doesn't matter. that's like irrelevant, but I mean
yeah,
you know,
bring me the blood of the virgin comedians.
It was different for him because I didn't meet him, you know, as a comedian. I just met him as a patron.
Yeah,
you know the story.
Yeah.
Right.
I've heard it in tidbits, so if you guys want to tell it to me.
It's really quick. I was at, yeah. We were at the Brea Improv,
yeah. Brea
and
Improv.
I was doing midget jokes, and literally half the audience is laughing. And after
only
about
half.
Two punchlines, literally half the audience is laughing.
And usually it's
And
crushes.
I don't mean like half of the audience mixed. I mean
One side
of the room is laughing, and the other is not.
And this is not how it usually goes, or?
No. God, no. Fuck, dude. If I ever told jokes more than once on stage that only got 50%
yeah.
laughs, I would fucking stop doing comedy.
Yep.
It's listen, every bit that I write either gets an applause break or it doesn't end up in my act. It's that simple.
Awesome.
I mean, you know, the scrutiny that needs to be gone through in order for it to end up in my act is just ridiculous.
Yeah,
for me.
So to have half the crowd laughing, that's something that you would obviously know.
Correct.
Because, and you would obviously notice, because this is not normal.
No,
And is your first thought, all right, well, after tonight,
No. My first immediate thought was like, okay, is there a fucking midget over here on the side of the room? That's immediate. Like, I just was, it was, that's literally what I said. And I look and I just see two little tiny arms waving kind of above everybody else, but not really.
Yeah.
So I was like, get over here.
Yeah.
Get over here, little man.
And that's me. I was there with my dad. I was there. I took him to see Carlos for a Father's Day present.
Nice.
And because he kind of shares the same mentality.
Yep.
And yeah, then all of a sudden he's doing these midget jokes. By the way, I was the only one on that side laughing. Like, it was very audible. You just hear, just me.
Right.
Was this your first time hearing a professional comedian like make fun of little people?
This is my first time at a stand-up comedy show.
Oh, so you had no idea that this could even be tackled as a...
Didn't know this was a... Like, I knew it was a profession, but didn't know the logistics
right.
of it, didn't know
okay.
how a show even worked. So, yeah, then Mencia calls me up on stage
And so you just said, fuck it. All right.
Yeah.
Whoever you, like, you're causing this laughter to be split.
I'm fearless on stage, bro. Off stage, like, it's really funny. We just did this show for the Travel Channel, and we were recording, and they were like, hey, just walk up to people and see what happens. And I was like, that's not who I am, bro. I will never be that comic who goes on the street and just accosts people and talks to them and tries to get... I can't do that. If you don't know that I'm a comedian, then you don't know that what I'm saying is just intended to be a joke.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like pulling pranks on people who believe shit and then that's funny. That's just not me. So, but when you come to my show, you got to know that it's, I mean, I've never hidden my comedy. From my first special till now, they've all been fucking relentless and just fearless.
Yeah.
So I'm doing midget jokes and half the audience is laughing. And I say, is there one there? And he's there. I got to bring him on stage. Yeah. It was just immediate. It wasn't even like a question. It was just like, get up here, bro. We gotta fix this before we can move on. We got to address this little fucking issue right now. That's and then awesome. Move on. And I didn't know if he was laughing or not. I didn't know that he was the one. All I knew is that when he said he was there, he was okay with the attention. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So then I bring him up on stage and I ask him where he works. And he says Disneyland, and I can't stop fucking laughing.
The audience, too. Yeah. At this point, they're like, all right, this plan.
No, I think I found it. I have it recorded, so we can actually do it. But if I'm not mistaken, the audience was kind of like, wait, is this.
What the fuck is.
Are you planted?
Yeah,
or like, wait a minute. And then. When he said that, I think the audience was like, this is too perfect.
Yeah,
this
right.
No, fuck no. But I couldn't believe that. And then he told me that he was a bodyguard for Mickey and and why and all this stuff.
Only
and,
because Santa fired him. Like he just like kept saying, you know.
It just keeps going, man.
It was awesome. And then so we did a little thing, and then he told me that he danced hip hop, so we played some hip hop music, and he did this.
Oh God!
The one thing I'll never forget is when you did the inchworm.
Yeah.
So it's like the worm is like this. The inchworm is literally him like turning into a ball really, really slowly, and then expanding really slowly. It looked like when I was a kid, there was this like either you had a big wheel if you had money, but if you didn't, there was this ghetto thing that was kind of like a big worm, and the hump was in the middle.
Oh, with the two wheels.
Yeah,
totally
and you would go up and down, and it would actually make it go. That's what he did, but really fucking slow. And it was hysterical.
How did you not get the nickname Ghetto Big Wheel after that?
Oh, man. That's pretty solid.
So the crowd goes crazy.
The crowd goes nuts. And then, you know, once we established that relationship, he did that. He goes back on stage, and I did my act, and a year later, I'm at the Improv in Ontario, and he shows up, and it was awesome, and he told me that he'd been doing stand-up, that he's doing amateur nights and all this stuff, and I was like, cool, that's awesome.
Because I had started after that night. I had never done comedy before.
What about that night made you want to do it?
Just being up on stage, having a sold-out audience, just
that was your
laugh.
First taste of any sort of... Yeah. Well, you've done performing plays and stuff.
Yeah,
but this
plays
was...
and improv in high school, but not the direct of something I said in a moment, in a reaction, made a room full of people who were there, their laugh immediately give me that feedback.
And then you guys were having a conversation, so you were getting actual laughs from just stuff you were saying.
Yeah,
with no pressure, though. You have to understand it was a perfect scenario for a young comic to step into.
Yeah.
Because the pressure's on me. There's no pressure on him. Yeah. He's just there to answer questions and do whatever it is that happened in that show. And so he just kind of embraced all that energy and let it flow without it being any negativity whatsoever.
Yeah,
there was nothing about that situation that was bad.
Right. It's not doing your typical open mic where there's just a room of eight other comedians that are all like, well, we can't laugh at him because if we do, then he'll get called up.
And you weren't
something.
Trying to be funny either, were you?
No, like I wasn't trying. There were laughs, but
they were based on real truth, which, by the way, I can't imagine isn't even more just impactful in the sense that if you think about it, from this perspective, most comics, when we first start doing stand-up, we're either doing a version of whoever we think is the funniest guy. You know what I mean? Like, whoever that is, it's Eddie Murphy's when he was doing Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor was doing, you know, every comic, whoever they look up to, they are
they're doing like a version of that.
Yeah, when you first start, because that's what you know. It's kind of like every kid on the out there who wants to be like Mike or who wants to be like LeBron or who wants to. They're out there doing that first until they become something of their own. He didn't have to do that. He literally got laughs the first time on stage about something that he said that wasn't made up, that wasn't necessarily a joke.
Yeah.
That wasn't written like a joke. It was literally, I'm little, and yeah, you're not going to believe this, but I am a bodyguard for Mickey Mouse.
Laugh.
And the audience just goes crazy. Yeah. And I cannot imagine that that wasn't just so intoxicating on so many levels.
It was.
Because he got to do it in front of an audience that was awesome, in front of an audience that was acceptance. It was sold out.
And
the energy was amazing.
And with you, who...
Right.
You were my favorite comic.
Right.
I'd seen your Comedy Central Presents special.
Right.
And was just like, I love this guy. I love this voice. This is a special that came out right after 9/11.
Right.
And I was just like, this is the dude. And then I get to see you. And then it's like
how do you not start standing up?
And you get to and you get to share after that.
Yeah.
Must have been awesome.
Yeah. So like for you, Adam, that would be like if you went to the Key Arena and then you got to shoot free throws with Def LaShrimp.
Wow.
Like how like you're an NBA player then.
I mean, there's more famous Sonics. I mean, Kemp would have been great. You know?
I'm gonna go Def LaShrimp.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Wow.
They're
I would have went with Kemp, and then you might be one of his kids.
Yeah.
Because he had like nine kids from like nine different women.
A lot, man.
Yeah.
There was a time I saw him at a movie theater in sixth grade, and I think we were seeing, I want to say Angels in the Outfield, but it was some sort of weird kids comedy.
And the whole sixth grade, your whole class were his kids.
Yeah.
Oh, but look. Kemp's kids are here. Oh, is that the name of a charity? No, it's just Kemp's kids.
Yeah. Well, he walked in with, and he was the biggest dude I've ever seen in my entire life. You know, 6'10", still in amazing shape. And there's a tiny little white woman he's with.
Yeah.
And they sit in the back of the theater. And it was like in the middle of the afternoon on like a Sunday, so there was not a lot of people at the theater. And my buddy and I, the whole time, I can't remember what comedy was, but every time something funny would happen, we'd turn around and be like, what does Sean Kemp think about that moment? Do we have similar sensibilities? And we look back like three or four times, and 20 minutes in, I'll never forget it, one time we turn back about 20 minutes in, and he's gone. And we already knew that there were all the accusations about multiple kids. So as soon as he left, my buddy and I even looked at him, we were like, dude, should we go try to find him and stop him from making another Kemp?
It's number 10. Yeah. Come on, man.
But again, we had to see how Rookie of the Year finished up.
Well, obviously. So then it's like a year later, it's at the Ontario Improv. And this time I see you before the show.
Right.
And
you're like, hey, man, I've been doing stand-up. I'm still a virgin. Like, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Pretty much.
So then Bert. My brother was like, you should put him on. Now, my immediate reaction, believe it or not, was, you know what? He's a young comic. I'm sure he's never done as a stand-up a room like this.
Yeah.
And most people don't understand how fragile our egos are in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And you give a young comic who's not ready an opportunity to shine, and they don't. It can really devastate their growth for a long time, no pun intended.
Right.
And I was afraid of that. I was afraid that, you know, because believe it or not, I never thought, even at that moment, I didn't look at Brad as a little person.
Yep.
I just saw him as a young comic.
Yep.
Who was going to go up on stage and possibly eat shit
in front of
a sold out crowd. Yeah. Of course, go up there with all these like, I'm going to kill, and walk off with like, you know, that, I mean, that literally, and believe it or not, think this in my head, I'm going, okay, how long is it going to take this kid to get over bombing? When is he going to be in front of a crowd this big again with the opportunity to reverse what happened?
Yeah.
Because for months and months and months, maybe years, he's only going to be doing amateur nights. He's only going to be doing those kinds of shows. When is he going to be in this environment again in order to be able to make up in his head? I said, no, I don't
want
to put this kid through that.
You didn't
That's
want
not
to have
cool.
That on your conscience.
Fuck no, man.
Yeah.
So I told Bert, I go, what if he bombs? And I swear to God, I'll never forget it. Bert looks at me and he goes, he's a midget. They're going to laugh. What the fuck are you thinking? And I went, all right, okay. That's what you think. He's like, dude, they're going to laugh. He's going to. And he knew. He was like so far ahead of it because Bert's seen me perform and been around comedy forever and ever back in the day when I was doing stand-up. He was underage and he went with me to work.
Yeah.
When I was working the door and doing stand-up. So he's seen every comic, every scenario you can imagine. And he was like, dude, he's going to go up there. He's going to do midget jokes. He's going to get laughs. He might not kill, but he's going to get laughs.
Yeah.
He's going to be like, it's going to help him grow
help
like
him,
you can't imagine. So I was like, all right. And that's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because that was the day ironically as well, that something was born in me bringing comics back up on stage after shows. Because I wouldn't do that as much. I don't even know if I did that before that. But I brought him up. I brought Steve up. I brought my openers up. And then
this it is just after became you close some. Out your,
yeah, yeah, I said goodnight. And then yeah. I brought them up on stage so they could have fun. And then it just turned into this thing, man. And then that's where the lap dance was born.
That night,
the yeah. lap dance was born.
What?
A dance off was born.
Do you have footage of this?
Footage, no, but it's audio. Recorded. Yeah, all recorded.
Yeah, because
the lap, because that's become a, you know,
it was
a bachelorette party.
Yeah, it was a bachelorette party. Ned asked him to come up on stage.
Well, yeah, then, I basically made fun of her because I was like, you know, your boyfriend right now is getting, you know, sat on by some hot chick with big tits. You know that, right? And you're in this comedy club thinking this is your last day, like the last day to even like. To do anything. And I'm not saying you're going to have sex, but yeah. just get close just to it. You should have a dick in your face or something. I was like, get the fuck up here. You know what I mean? And she got up on stage and I said, you know, and then I said, you're going to get a lap dance. I think Steve did the lap dance first.
Right.
Right. Something like that. And they didn't think he would do it. And I didn't even ask him.
Yeah.
All I said was like, you'll never forget the day you got a lap dance from a midget. And the audience just goes,
So then you had no choice.
I'm like, well, yeah. step up.
The people have spoken.
Oh, I will tell you this, though. He's doing all these little dances. And then I remember leaning up to him going, just jump on top of her. Like, because she was sitting down on a chair. And I was like, just jump on her lap and hump her. And
he can jump. And like,
oh, dude.
When Brad gets air.
That's when the jump happened, bro. That's when that little air.
Into the jump?
No. He did that after.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cartwheel wasn't born yet.
Nah, it wasn't born. The cartwheel into it wasn't born yet.
But
it was literally, he just ran, jumped, boom, landed on her lap. And then I took off his shirt. I remember that.
Oh, yeah. You did do
the
that.
Audience went crazy.
And by the way, that's an important part of that whole dance, the shirt coming off. Because once you stick the landing,
it's like
people go nuts, but then it's like they're not expecting the shirt to come off.
Well, all the pageantry of that joke was probably born somewhere on tour with me. Unless there's something that he did after that was different from the actual pageantry of it, the actual building of first do this, then do this, then do this, then do that. You know what I mean? It was because I taught him how to build it like a joke.
Right.
You know, that time was the first time that we did it. But after that.
So you're like, all right, now this is something. So you knew immediately, you were like, this is something you should incorporate.
No. He was doing it with me. He couldn't do it at that point on his own because there was nowhere for him to do it at amateur nights.
Right. Yeah.
So the only time he would do it
was like when he was on the road. Okay.
When he was opening for me. But what I did was I told him technically, look, every joke is built like this. But when they know where this is going, it's a different atmosphere. When everybody knows what you're going to do or they anticipate it, your job at this point is to build it then. Don't give it to him right away. You know what I mean? Just
it's joke kind of, foreplay.
It's So first teaser a little bit. Teaser, act sexy, and the audience will laugh. They'll be like, "Oh," then get close. But don't. And it got built to a point where that joke was just perfected to a point where it wouldn't matter where we did it or how it was just
that's incredible.
Was perfect
it was
and exact.
Yeah.
But it took a minute to get it that good.
And I remember after that, after that show, you said, come back.
Right.
So I came back the next night. And then I think it was the next night where you said, like, what are you doing next weekend?
Right.
And so the next weekend you were playing the Fox Theater in Bakersfield.
Right.
And so here 2 weeks ago, I was doing open mics with maybe 20 people in the audience max, and now I'm doing the Fox Theater in Bakersfield, opening up for Mencia, which is 1,200.
No, Jesus. It's like 16.
Yes, 1,600.
How much time would you
have? We did two shows.
Yeah, and
just like 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, him? 10, 15? No, fuck no. I was doing like four.
Yeah, okay.
Four or five.
Yeah, because I was.
Is that how you did it with your openers, or was it also because you just that's where he was at?
Every opener is different. I think what happens with me is like. Early in my career, because I came from the projects and I wanted to help people, I chose
the projects
a lot of
in
comics.
Honduras?
No, here in East LA. Mm-hmm. The Maravilla projects in East LA. I was trying to help people that were kind of broken, so to speak. You know what I mean? People that not only were funny, but that had something else to overcome, whether it was something personal, something. I was just trying to help.
So people that were in comedy.
All comedians, but trying to help them
more
than just
or
in comedy.
Calligraphy artists or
no, I helped some. I helped some DJs and stuff like that too. Yeah. But that wasn't the case. The case was with stand up, especially early in my career. I wanted to help not just any comic, but comics that maybe weren't given opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah,
like a little person.
Yeah,
you know, or some Hispanic or whatever it was.
Does that stem
it was
from
something extra
where you grew up, or was that just like people did that for you and you were in turn?
I don't know. Like, I didn't have a mentor like that. Ever since I started doing comedy, I'd been kind of a loner, but not on purpose. It was more because I remember the first time I performed at the Comedy Store. As soon as I got off stage, somebody said to the then at the time Hispanic comedian on the roster, "Oh, that dude's going to take your job." And so he was talking about me.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, "What the fuck? I have nothing to do with that. Like, that's nothing." So then all of a sudden,
right,
there was an antagonistic kind of thing happening there. And so I immediately just disengaged from that. And I never even paid attention to it, to a fault and a detriment at some point, because
like
I didn't befriend anybody.
Shit.
Anybody.
Yeah, you
not on purpose. Yeah. I can't live in that environment, bro. I never have. I don't live in the negative. I don't live in shitville. Here's an example. I wear this shirt because I'm a Real Madrid fan. And when I do, a lot of people that are Barcelona fans, who is like the opposing team, yell out negative stuff and say whatever and say that, you know, the team that I cheer for sucks. I don't enjoy saying that other teams suck. I don't like that.
I didn't know it's a part of sports and just the.
Well, here's the way I look at it. All right. If your team sucks and I beat your team, what joy do I get from being a team
you
that sucked?
You beat the team, so that's what you just focus
I beat
on
a
the
team
joy.
That sucked.
Yeah.
But it's not even an accomplishment is my point. I beat a team that sucked.
That's what you're supposed to
do. But what if it's like the rivalry between like the Celtics and Lakers at one point, right? And it was like, I mean, and you.
But the reason why it was a great rivalry is because they were both great teams.
Right, okay. So
to yell out that one sucks is.
Yes, yeah. They don't suck. They got to the finals. They're clearly not.
It's stupid and it diminishes what your team's accomplishment is.
Totally.
So I never went to that place. So I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I didn't smoke weed. I didn't do any of that stuff. I couldn't sit around and talk shit about Roseanne because she had a TV show. I couldn't sit around and talk shit about
And that's
whomever.
What was happening. And I mean, it still
happens. It's still what happens.
It's always,
come on now.
Yeah.
It's still what happens.
So you just wanted to just orient yourself with any sort of negative energy because you were like, I already realize how difficult this profession is and I need everything.
I just need to be focused for myself.
There's already people against you that you haven't even met. So
never
why
even
be
met
around?
Him. Didn't even know who he was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tony Ray. Didn't even know
Isn't
who he was
crazy?
At the time.
Just immediately just like pegging and trying to suck you into a world of shit that you have nothing to do with. Well, other than being maybe a similar flavor.
Sure, but I mean, I'm sure that it happens. I mean, look, I know that it happens for everybody else. You know, I was watching a documentary the other day on the comics from Boston. Have you guys seen the one?
Oh, yeah, when stand-up stood out.
Right,
yeah,
and it was awesome, and everybody was happy, and everybody loved each other until
Bobcat. And then Bobcat made it.
One of them made it, and boom, it blew everybody else up. And then it wasn't just Bobcat. It was, God, what's his name? God, the comedian, the one tone, he tells a lot of...
Stephen Wright?
Stephen Wright, that's right. Yeah. Stephen Wright went on and he blew up and then it was just like, you know, Lenny Clark was like, why? And, you know, and it just became a completely different environment after that because they just, you know, didn't, at that point it was like, why not me?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand all of that shit. I didn't get that because ever since I started doing stand-up, all I've ever done is try to help young comics, you know, get to a better place.
You brought so many on the road with you.
Yeah,
I found them, found him.
Yeah, you're Jay Moore likes to talk about comic coaching trees, Bill Belichick came from the Bill Parcells coaching tree.
Right.
If you look at your coaching tree, these are the names that you brought on the road. It's David Tell. it's Joe Coy, it's Cristela Alonso, it's myself, it's Bobby Lee,
yeah.
it's Freddie Soto, it's Pablo Francisco.
Jesus.
All these people
right.
came from your treat. Like, Attell was East Coast, but you kind of, you said you brought him on the road for like
He'd never really
tours.
Done big theater stuff. And
yeah.
And it was, you know what? And Attell was one of those things. He wasn't on the, we didn't do a buttload of shows together. It wasn't years with him, but mm-hmm. I wanted my fans, whom I had a decent fan base at the time, to see a different style of comedy that I thought was hysterical,
yeah.
that I enjoyed personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
and
when
was
I brought him on the road.
What, did you make a conscious effort to also have whoever opened for you be different?
No.
Yeah.
Didn't care.
Because, you know, some people are like, it's got to be, if I'm a white dude, it's got to be a fat black dude or a chick
No. There was only one comic that I couldn't bring on the road because it was literally, and I won't mention the name.
You can say her name, Rita Rudner. And you know what, Rudner?
Yeah, Rita.
You're still doing pussy jokes, and it's time to grow up.
It's time to stop using profanity. It seriously is. You know what I mean? And fuck! That's mine. It's, there's only one person, and it was one of those things where somebody said to me, look, that kid kind of looks up to you, and it sounds like Carlos Light, and then Carlos Mencia.
Oh, shit, yeah.
And that's a bad show.
Yep.
It's not. It's just a bad show.
And
there was nothing I could do because I didn't want him to change.
Yep.
This was who he was.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. so, you know, like there's somebody like that kind of, Juan Villarreal, but the difference is he's so ghetto, so ghetto
yeah.
that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But watching Juan sometimes, if you watch my performances way back
like
in the mid-90s,
like your first two HBO
and
specials.
And you watch Juan throughout his career, he still has mannerisms and shit that sound just exactly the way I did because I was such a huge influence in his career.
But
I enjoy that, and I don't like... I don't like throwing the names out there because I don't want to take responsibility for that. I appreciate
yeah,
that I helped out.
Of course. But I think that does happen so rarely where people are that, like, and I guess comics specifically, that selfless to be like, because I know headliners that just they don't want people that are stronger than them in front of them or somebody they like. They want somebody so, you know, not... it's not going to be a problem to follow or...
I want...
Right.
I want somebody to take it to...
Trying to blow you out of the water.
Yes,
yeah.
man. I want that.
It
That's
makes you
exciting.
Raise your game, yeah.
I mean, it's you know, I don't ever remember being afraid, but I love that.
Yeah.
You know, bring it.
And
it's awesome.
I remember when I first started open for you, you told me, like, hey, just so you know, don't get too comfortable. You told me, like, this is college. You're here for a little while. You're going
right.
to learn... And then you're going to go off on your own.
Right.
And so you installed that mentality in me. And you said, yeah, do whatever you need to do. Kill,
right.
fucking destroy. Like, you had Joe Coy on the Punisher tour. And that was coming off his Tonight Show set where he got a standing ovation. And I think, like, maybe one of the first standing ovations since you got one.
Right.
And so that set is literally flawless and perfect. And then you put him on before me on that tour. And I'm about... 3 years in, I bombed so many nights on that tour.
Wow. Yeah,
but it made me better because I had to follow Joe Coy.
Of course. Do you say anything to him after that type of stuff happens, or you just go let him sit in that feeling?
No,
and go,
I always talk to these
that.
Guys.
Yeah.
No. I always talk to these guys. Probably, I talk to these guys so much that they forget who I am. I impart so much knowledge to these guys, and I share so much with them on that level that there are points in time where they forget. Like, here's the pattern with comedians. I'll go to some comedy club somewhere, and some comedian will say, hey, I want to go, you know, is it cool if I do a guest spot? You know, and mm-hmm. I'll say, yeah, man, as long as the managers from this club are okay with it, cool. Because before, a couple of times I let comics on, and then they got banned from the club for a year.
Oh, shit.
Because they asked me.
Oh,
instead of asking the manager,
right.
and the manager was like, "What the fuck are you doing? Don't go up to him." Yeah, exactly.
Now, do you think there is a fine line between though, like it's your show, your weekend, it's your name, so you should have final say, or do you think you have to also give a little leverage to the club and go, "All right, we're in their house," but
I don't even care about like, dude, my ego doesn't get involved in that kind of shit.
Yeah.
For me, it's just like it's about you. Go ask the manager for you, not for me. I don't care.
Yeah,
I. Your appearance on my show is not going to make my show ridiculously better or ridiculously worse. This is really just an opportunity for you to shine in this
Unless you were a bouncer for Mickey, I don't know how you're going to add.
but even that, I mean, you know, without look, I would have got a standing ovation that night
without
any of that happening. Of course. Wouldn't have mattered. It's just, you know, my mentality is incorporate whatever's there, but I'm going to do my job no matter what. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant to me. I have a process upon which I know that my show is going to have a beginning, a middle, and a badass ending, and that's just how all shows are built. Doesn't matter where. So I want to bring these guys on. And so what happens is I bring them for about a year. And for a year, they're awesome. No problem. Whatever you need. Everything's cool. At around the year, attitude starts. At around the year, it's when it's all of a sudden like, do you want me to fucking, you want me to pick up your bag and take it to your fucking room? You know, like, it just that little bit of attitude inside of them, like, I don't need to be fucking doing this, whatever that thing outside of opening is. Or it's like, how come I can't do fucking 10 minutes? Because you're doing 7. Because that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you know, but at first, it sucks because I don't know it. I just sense that weirdness, just a little tinge of like, what the fuck is going on? What's wrong? So it's me going, what's wrong with, what's his name? What's wrong? What's her name? And you know what I mean? And then it just becomes, you know, this nasty festering shit where I got to get rid of them. And it's made me change how I operate.
And it totally happened with me too.
It happens with every comic.
Yeah. It's like what you were talking about, where when we hang out and we play golf and then we talk after the shows and we're going over sets, and there comes a point where, I mean, we're friendly, but then like the opener forgets, like, oh right, this is my boss. Like, yes, I'm.
Yep.
Yes, it's the world of stand-up comedy.
I've been given an opportunity that's not, you know.
Right.
But not even just that. Just what I do on stage. Okay, here's kind of what. Even if I could get a standing ovation every single show, every single night with these guys, and they still, after a year, kind of forget that. They still forget that. That's where this advice is coming from.
Yeah.
It's coming from a guy who, no matter what has ever surrounded me, no matter what negativity, no matter how bad shit has got, no matter anything, I have still been always able to go on stage and rock a crowd. Like, doesn't matter, you know, what situation I've been put in. It's just, it's always been that way. And so that's where I come from with these guys, to try to help them get to that level.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's purely because, you know, everybody needs to be given an opportunity to shine. If I think that they can.
Right.
That's kind of where I go with it.
Now, were you also there for the origins of the Bobby Lee lap dance? Because Bobby, the same way you have done for everyone we've mentioned, Bobby did that for me at the store, and I went out with him for 3 years.
Bobby got that from me.
And he, you know what's so crazy? Before I had even met you, he told me so many stories and referenced how good you were all the time, and because, you know, he would always tell me, he's like, you got it so good, man. And it's like, you know, and I'd like, you know, and just the way he would, you know, pay for me and just be so generous, and he would always reference how, you know, you were with him and the opportunities, and he's like, because, you know, he didn't have to see me at the store, want to hang out, ask me to come on dates with him, like hook it up and give me extra cash at the end of the show. I mean, but, you know, when I started to do shows with Brad, and I was like, oh, lap dance, Bobby, two completely different lap dances.
Right.
Right.
But, I mean, was that...
That was born all... lap dances at the end of shows like that were all born from
your tour.
From me, from my tour.
Yeah.
All of them were.
Exactly.
They all come from there.
Yeah, and...
It's ironic how much shit was built off of coming out on tour, and ironically, like, for some period of time, I was known as the opposite, which is fucking bizarre.
Now, your style of, like, just crushing that hard, I mean, like, you know, there hasn't been a show like you said where you just feel like you have. Did you go into stand up with that mentality of like, I want to be? Because when you don't have your point of view and your style formed yet, I mean, was it the people you saw that you were like, I want to crush like that? Or are you just from how you were funny growing up, it was just like you'd get belly laughs from telling stories?
It was insecurity. It was funny because, but I always knew it. I would tell people, I will never bomb. Mm-hmm. And they're like, is it because you think you're the shit? No. It's the opposite, because I know I can. I know that any given day I can go up on stage and eat shit. Because I know that, I will never let that happen. Ever. And how long have you known me?
Coming on 10 years now.
All right. He's seen me perform for 10 years, thousands of shows.
Yeah.
Literally thousands of shows in front of 5 people, 20, 10,000, 5,000, 15,000.
Yeah.
Ask him if he's ever seen a shitty set. Yeah. Now, don't misunderstand me. I walk off stage 99% of the time saying, I fucked up. I could have done this, right. I've never had a perfect set. I've had a couple of sets where I wouldn't change anything, but they weren't perfect.
Of course.
But you can ask him. Yeah. You can ask him how many sets I've had.
The most impressive stuff that I would see was when I was as a monologue writer on Mind of Mencia, and I would go with you to the Comedy Store, and we would go to the...
That's when I first met you, I think, too.
Yeah, and then we would go to the original room, and there would be 15 people in the audience. It was on a Monday or a Tuesday. Shitty crowd. Comics going up, just bombing. Like, no one's getting laughs. And then you would go on, and you would get it, the audience of 15 right. into like an uproar, and then you would and then you would yell to me in the back of the room, Brad, how long did that take?
Yeah,
I'd be like 7 minutes. It took you 7 minutes to switch the shit crowd into now this monster crowd, and now
and then I would do and then I would and I would mix in the new shit that we were gonna do for the show. In between all doing that, I was still trying to, you know, create a monologue for Mind of Mencia.
Right. With new shit, do you always try to, are you an advocate of not doing it? I mean, sure, at this point, since you're just so polished, like, would you do it to open a show, like in a theater tour? Would you open, if something happened, like,
you did that all the time.
Hours before.
I do it all the time.
Would you, you would do 10, 15 minutes of just stuff that
I
never
didn't
said?
Know, I didn't know how rare this was. I really didn't. My ability to write without worrying about how's it going to do or... I mean...
You just have a very articulate... You see exactly
what
you want.
No, it's math for me. For me, it's an equation. I every joke has an equation to it. If you're going to tell this kind of joke, then you just... for me, I just put attitudes, feelings, emotions, writing, words all together, and everyone has an equation. So you can tell a certain joke a certain way, but it won't be funny in another way. And so it's all about the rhythm within the context of putting all that equation together. So once I know what the equation is, it's simple. Listen, he's seen it. He's literally seen – I've literally been in a car listening to talk radio, right, with Brad. Mm-hmm. And something happens, and I said, that's going to be funny tonight. And Brad's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
that story right now that you just heard.
It was
that
a commercial
story.
For Rite Aid.
It's going to be funny. Yeah. And Brad, like,
I remember. I remember one time it was you were listening to Dennis Prager, and
a talk radio.
Yeah, that's a talk
conservative
radio guy
talk radio. Oh, an old Jewish conservative guy.
Nice.
Right. Yeah,
and we were driving to the Comedy Store, and I forget exactly what he said, but he said something, and you just kind of did one of those like, I'm going to talk about this tonight.
And you don't write it down. You just start like, I mean, you're writing in your head, obviously, as
right.
you hear.
Always.
Okay.
Yeah. But I remember all that stuff.
Did you ever, were you always some notepad or computer?
Never.
What the fuck?
Never.
No set, no like, first time I headlined, I typed up the set list and put it on the stage in front of me because I was like, you know,
that hinders my process.
Of course. To this day, though, I'm having the notepad or anything. Right. So if you have that to look to, you're going to be like, I'm not going to be present and.
No, the reason why that does it for me is because, as you know, every audience, when they get together, for some reason, get up one personality. I don't know what this is. There's I cannot explain.
Well, the audience collectively just decides this is who we are tonight.
But you know this. Yeah. I mean, that's why you can tell a joke tonight and it'll kill, and then the next night you tell it exactly the same to a completely different audience and they don't laugh.
Yeah.
It's just I don't know what happens when people get together, but their energy becomes synergistic and they become one. So I treat that audience like an individual that I've never met. And so I don't know you. So I'm going to learn how to talk to you while I'm doing my act.
Yeah, that's exactly
and
what
so
it is.
Every single show I begin to grasp where they're coming from, why they're doing it. Like the moments that he's talking about at the Comedy Store, they were easy for me because here were people that paid to see a show that didn't care that it was empty, and then they kind of got shit on by a bunch of comics that said, yo, look at this motherfucking crowd, blah, blah, blah. And I just went up there basically and told them the truth. Like, look, you're here, I'm here. If you don't laugh, you're the one that didn't laugh. It doesn't matter to us.
Yeah.
And I have more people in my family that are in this fucking room right now. I have 11 sisters and 6 brothers. That's 18. There's 15. I'm going to give you a great show, but you got to be there for me too. And if you're there for me, I'll be there for you. And then they'll be like, yeah, fuck it. That's what we're here for. And then that energy would come up, and then it would just be like, boom, 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 boom. And then, you know, I would do that all the time, though. It wasn't with just him. I'd do it with Albert all the time. To go to the Comedy Store when how many people have bombed in a row or not had great sets way back in the day. And probably didn't do well for public relations on my behalf. But I, you know what? I never looked at it like I never was trying to put other comics down. I was never trying to shit on any other comic other than the fact that I wanted to go on stage and reward these people for being there.
Well, and
I mean, that's all I cared about.
Yeah,
that's all I ever cared about.
And that's something that I think when comics say they don't like you, I think a lot of them are projecting their thoughts onto your actions, being that, like, the things that you did, they say, like, well, if I acted that way, this is why I would have acted that way. Whereas they don't see it from the perspective of a guy who's like, I'm going on stage, I'm going to do the set that I need to do to make me a better comedian for my paying audiences, and then I'm going to get the fuck out.
Yeah.
And then I'm just driving away. I'm not going
to hang out. Yeah, they're like, why does he want to stick around and let us, like, talk shit while he's standing over there or engage in shit talking with us? I mean, it's...
Or pick my brain at that point because, you know, maybe I could have helped them out. But on the other side of that, I was already helping out Steve and Brad and Christella and all these guys. So I didn't have it in me, you know, to do that at the time.
It really is crazy. I want to comment on something you said about, like, getting to know a crowd, like getting to know how to talk to them. And it's like, that just made me think how incredible it is. How amazing we all are right now. But just the idea, because it's not like people come in and fill out a questionnaire like, this is what offends me. And we don't get that before we go up and go, all right, I can't do Jew jokes tonight. I can do a couple political things. But it's so like the figuring out how to talk to, and you can't ever, I mean, and you're just doing that based on everything that you know, your point of view to then.
But it's also listening to, like, feeling the vibe. Like, I can't tell you how many times, I mean, back when I was really, really growing as a comic, but I kind of knew what I was doing. I would walk into the Comedy Store with Albert.
You worked there, by the way, yeah?
And I worked there. I was a doorman at night, and I was like a gopher, a runner during the day for like 4 years.
Who was there while you were working there, real quick? Who were the people that everyone was, you know, that you would like try to leave the door for a minute to pop in and watch?
Oh, everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. You know what? I can literally tell you that every single comic I ever saw, from, you know, Charles Corzar, Jackson Purdue, to, you know, Steve Greenlee, guys that you never even heard of, they all influenced me in some way, shape, or form. I think the only difference, in my opinion, between any comic I've ever seen that has made it or hasn't made it or whatever, is consistency. That's it. I don't know one comic I ever saw that didn't have a great joke or didn't at one point write some amazing shit.
Consistency in terms of just going on stage all the time?
No, consistency of getting huge laughs with every single joke, with every single crowd, except for George Wallace and A.J. Jamal. Those two guys, I have never seen them ever have a bad set.
Wow.
Ever. And ironically, they don't cuss. But they just had this. AJ was all positive energy. It was just this overflowing effervescence of light and happiness. And just, I mean, he was like the Tony Robbins of comedy.
Oh, shit.
I swear to God, he literally went on stage.
Watch him and be like, I could walk across Kohl's right now.
Right. Like, I envy those guys because I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can get from point A to point D or Z like they can, but I can't do it like them. I mean, that, like, AJ would literally just go up and say, how you doing? And everybody was like, oh, shit, yeah, here's a happy black guy that doesn't cuss. I like it. You know what I mean? And I had to work at it. I had to, you know,
so you're saying he was super likable.
Jokes.
Were you not super likable when you got on stage? You feel like you had to earn people's...
I was likable, but not in that way.
Yeah.
I was likable in the sense that I could get away with saying some fucking just unbelievable shit. Like, I remember...
But not out of the gate, yeah. You had to get them on your side, obviously.
Yeah, but like I remember one time I was at the Comedy Store and I had this bit because there was a mall in Torrance where there was a black Santa Claus that got hired. Oh, this is before the internet. So he got hired over fax. So he sent the fax in saying, I've been Santa Claus this many times. They checked his references. References cleared. Mm-hmm. He shows up and he's black. And they fired him because they're like, there is no black Santa Claus.
Wow.
So I went on stage, and this was mid-90s. So I went on stage, and I was like, first of all, Santa Claus is a mythical fucking figure that nobody's seen. So I know that they paint him as white, but you really don't fucking know what color the guy is. Right. Nobody's ever really fucking seen him.
Yeah.
And then I just went on this, like, it was pretty simple, but, it, you know, back in the day, you got to put in a context that this was 20 years ago. And I said, I think Santa Claus is black. You know what I mean? He breaks into your house. You don't know what he is. And I just did, and it was a black crowd. And they're dying. They're dying. And I remember I got off stage, standing ovation, and the next comic who was black literally just went on stage and said, fuck you niggas. Fuck you motherfuckers letting that spick do nigga jokes. And man, fuck you motherfuckers. Fuck that. And I was just like,
holy shit.
Whoa, holy shit.
And you were
shit.
Like, hey, Rita Runner, take it easy.
And I just, you know what I mean? And I didn't understand that because I would never feel that way if a black comic went up stage and did a Latino crowd and started doing jokes about, you know, welfare and whatever it was. I just didn't understand, like, where that was coming from.
Was that
from.
Kind of your first taste of seeing, like, oh, wow, this guy?
No. But my problem was I didn't pay attention to it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't look at it like it. I just went like, oh, he's going to make fun of me. Don't give a shit.
And why should you pay attention to it?
I should have because I could have, I should have, I didn't have the wherewithal. Looking back, there's no other way I could have achieved all the things that I've achieved if I didn't operate the way I did operate. But I wish I could talk to these guys after the show and be like, hey, bro,
sure.
Why are you mad at me, dude?
But you were just like, you know, I'm going to get out of here after my set. So you think some of your...
I alienated a lot of comics by not befriending them, not hanging out, not, you know, and
it wasn't because it was because you, so that thing happened early on with the guy saying like, oh, right. You guys might have beef.
Right.
And you were just like, well, I'm going to come here and treat this like a job and do my thing and get out of here and go to the next spot. And people took that as, oh, this guy is not social. And also people take that if you don't want to be around, especially at a place like the Comedy Store that's very fraternal, that it's like, oh, you don't want to, you just want to come in and get out of here, so you're too good to like stand in the hallway and like
that's make what I felt, you know. I'm sure some of the other comics will say it's different or whatnot, but that's what I felt. And another thing is I never asked for utter loyalty from the guys that opened up for me,
right?
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I never asked those guys to like, as an example, Brad has called me up more than once and said, hey, man, so-and-so asked me to do a podcast or so-and-so asked me to do a radio show or so-and-so asked me to do a TV thing. And I was like, dude, before you even bring that shit up, do whatever the fuck you need to do to get more asses in seats and make your career great. I don't care. You know what I mean? I don't care who you work with or, you know, if they don't like me or whatever, that God, I don't care. I never did. But that cost me as well because, you know, when I had people saying negative things about me, I didn't have a support group. So it probably also looked like even the guys at Open Forum don't want to, like, sure. defend him, so
right.
to speak.
Wow.
But I didn't want to put these guys in that position as well. I mean, why would I want Brad or any of those guys that opened for me to lose a gig or to get into an altercation, even if verbal, or even just be in bad standing with somebody that could give them a night's work here or there, you know, just for me. It was like, why? I don't give a shit. I don't care.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean? I would call you up just because it's like, especially once I started going off and headlining on the road, I mean, and people ask me all the time, like, hey, do you still talk to Mencia? It's like, yes, I do, because he's my friend.
Right.
And so I never want to lose you as a friend.
Right.
So, and that's why to this day, you still get calls from me and texts from me when I do something, like, like something happens, I go, hey, just got an hour special on Showtime. Thank you, Ned.
Yeah.
And because I know that a lot of what I've done wouldn't have happened without you, or just would have taken a lot longer.
Right.
I mean, if not for those nights of bombing after Joe Coy, coming back on the bus and having you, I will always remember this, playing the song Fix You by Coldplay. And
when you're trying your best, but you don't succeed.
No, but that wasn't the best, bro.
And you were lip syncing
that. The best is Where Was I, bro. That's the best.
Oh, the Paul Thorne song.
The Paul Thorne song. Oh, my God. That is the greatest. I have it. I have it, brother.
No, I think I have it on my iPod. 656. Yeah, 56. So, like, this was a time when I found out that the current girl that I was dating.
That was like his young love, first love. Probably at one point thought he might marry her.
Yep.
Oh, shit.
I mean, it was that, like, deep.
Future Mrs. Brad.
And I swear to God, I just walk into the bus after the show, and he's sitting in the middle bunk.
Depressed.
His little legs dangling. Like,
even
so
sadder.
The bunk is literally about, I don't know, 2.5 to 3 feet. And so, you know,
yeah.
His feet are like 2.5 feet.
Yeah.
Looks like a sad
air,
kid who was waiting
just
to turn
like
for
a
the
little
seesaw.
Sad kid. Yeah. So I asked him, I was like, you know, what happened? And he was basically like, dude, I don't know. I mean, we were in love and we broke up. And I'm like, so why are you sad? I mean, you know, you broke up and you were kind of okay with it. And he's like, but dude, a day after we break up, she's like on her Facebook or MySpace back in the day.
Yeah.
It's like, she's on her MySpace page with this other dude. And I don't know what happened, man. We're like, what happened? And Paul Thorne sang this song. It was like, Where Was I? Oh, you got it?
That one? Yeah, this is the sad. Never listen to this song after a breakup.
Oh, God.
You will, and with any sort of sharp objects or anything near you. It's just awful.
Black and white TV back in grammar school.
If you both start crying right now.
I was watching Neil Armstrong walking on the moon.
Wow.
Yep.
That's pretended, I pretended I was an astronaut. On the playground monkey bars, I flew above the stars.
Yeah,
see, they could swap. This is your guys' I Will Remember You by Sarah McLachlan.
Oh, the night like, John Lennon died.
They could also
but this
play
is a really cool song.
Yeah, it's awesome.
DJ played Imagine and everybody cried.
It's a sick guitar ride.
Yeah.
I remember a thousand lighters held up in our hands. All we were saying.
Just so the viewers know, they're holding hands right now.
Let's give peace
this
a
line,
chance.
This line
but
right
this
here.
This was what made him cry.
Where was I when you stopped loving me? When did I become history? There's not many things that escape my memory.
And now your hands are on the window watching
me
walk
where
away.
Where was I when you stopped loving me?
And this one's
so,
and you're patting him on the back as the bus
no,
is driving
dude,
away.
No, dude, I'm not even next to him, bro. I'm like, so he has a bunk that is next to the back, which is the back is this suite, quote unquote, in a bus.
Sure.
And so it's just as loud as I can. And this was a really awesome stereo system. So really loud. I mean, all night, bro. All night.
Repeat.
Every day on repeat.
On repeat.
Where you know that's the worst way to get over
when
it.
When you stop loving
and then,
me.
And then you just hear me from my bunk go, where was I? I don't know.
Yeah.
Was I in Omaha? Was I in Bismarck, North Dakota? Where
oh
was
my
I?
God.
No, that was the best. What people don't understand is me making him face it that way was the best. It took him a weekend of that song and us making fun of him. For him to like get over that shit.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was just so in his face, relentless. And we weren't gonna baby him. And he's like, dude, we've all been here. Mm-hmm. You really think you're alone? Like all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, this song, it affects me. It just doesn't hurt me because it was back in the day. But we all have our where was I?
Sure.
Everyone does.
Right.
And so we just relentlessly. And every time he was sad. We just would put, where was I? And then he would just start laughing. And
dude, that's so
it took a week and it was gone.
Yeah. Get, I mean, that's why the road is so fucking great, too. Because, I mean, I'm curious if, was it all therapeutic adventures on the road, or was there some craziness, or was it just like...
Well, there's one story that I won't mind telling. This was in Cleveland. And
I remember.
Okay, so there was this girl that was just like... I was either on stage, or I was working, or I was doing something, and I was away from the group. While this happened, this girl... I won't say who, but had some fun with one of the members of our group, and and then I think actually another member of the group too, like two,
yeah,
and then I come backstage.
So she was a groupie.
Yeah, she's a groupie, and she had blown like two members of of the group. So then I come backstage and I meet her, and I'm meeting her for the first time. I don't know what's been happening. So I'm like hanging out and I'm talking and she's being interested. I'm like, oh man, this is really going
to
go somewhere.
We're like, Brad, take her to the back, bro.
And then the guy who she blew was like, you know what? You know what you guys should do right now? You guys should make out, like right now in front of all of us, like hardcore. You guys should just make out. I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm a man. I'll make out. So I just like start making out with this girl. And I knew something was up when I start making out, and the collective sound of the group was, oh!
Yeah. It was bad.
Because she had just blown two guys in our group. Like the
How hard did you scrub
before.
Your face?
Oh, my God. Not enough scope in the world, my friend. Not enough. I bathed in that shit for like 10 days.
It was. There were moments like that. There were moments. It was fun to watch these guys because I live vicariously through them. You know what I mean? They were doing all the craziness, and you know, I had all the pressure of being funny and kicking ass and you know doing all that stuff. So it was a different time, man.
Has your material? I'm envious at how much you talk about current events and political stuff and your family because I'm still. The family stuff, I think, is closest for me to start. We're good. I see maybe like 10 more.
Okay,
you good for like 10 more minutes?
Okay.
Awesome.
Cool. What were you always just from, did you have somebody from the get-go say, like, talk about this or with your family?
It took me a while, dude. It took me a while to become a decent writer. You know, at first it was, I'd never done stand-up and I never thought about doing stand-up. So there were a lot of comics that I remember saying, man, I wanted to do comedy when I was 16. Well, I wanted to start doing comedy when I was 20. Mm. I discovered comedy when I was 20, and I started doing comedy when I was 20. So my formative years as a stand-up for the first, I don't know, three or four were pretty much very simple premises with really a lot of attitude and performance to it. There were, like, I look back at a lot of that stuff, and I go, wow, that's an interesting premise. I would have done it completely different now than I did then. But, you know, I look at it and I go, wow, there I am. I see myself. You know what I mean? I go, oh, there I am in that joke. All right, cool. Then I'll tell another joke and be like, oh, there I am. So I see myself, but it's a completely different version of who I became. But once I learned, once I formatted my brain to take in information a specific way and spit it out a specific way, it's easy.
Yeah, so you feel like your point of view basically is what you're talking about.
It's just easy.
And did that come pretty... I mean, did you have odd jobs that helped you like be just in...
Once I started doing stand-up, I quit going to school. I quit my job. And
what was your
I
job?
Just started working. I was working at Farmers Insurance. Right. And I was going to school full-time, electrical engineering. That was it. I just started doing stand-up. There was nothing else. And
so you in your mind, you were like, all right, insurance, engineering. You at one point were just
I worked at Farmers to pay for school.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like I wanted to be at Farmers Insurance. It just happened to be a job that I came across, and it worked because I worked from 7 in the morning to 3, then from 5 to 10 I went to school every night. So it was easy.
But to quickly just find stand up and then just drop and go to that, I mean, was there something in you that was like, all right, I'm waiting for something to take me away from this?
No, I discovered my passion, man. I discovered my calling. I knew that this is what I was meant to do. And it took me about, like I said, about four or five years to begin to start writing decent. It took me 10 years to really go, okay, I can nail this stuff whenever I want to, like however it is. My problem, believe it or not, is that I do so much stuff about current events that if I don't do a special every year,
I was just going to say, yeah,
it goes away. It just goes away.
Because it's going to be replaced anyway by
It'll be replaced and it'll sound dated.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have this really, I mean, I don't say this about my bits, and he'll tell you, I never talk about my bits being like, but I have this one bit that I wish when it happened I would have put it on the air, because I haven't been as proud of a bit as that one. It's a bit about Donald Sterling. And interestingly enough, you know, when that whole stuff came out, I wrote that bit. Like, I literally wrote that bit 1 week after the entire Donald Sterling stuff came out. And it was born when I've met a lot of racist people.
Sure.
Not a shitload, but enough. And they always, always say the N-word. A lot. It's just racists love saying that shit.
Now, so, every flavor of person or all old white men?
It doesn't matter. They just love saying that word, whether they're Latino and racist, God, whether they're white and racist, whether they're black and racist, you know, or self-hate, whatever that would be called. They just love saying that word. And so the first time I heard Donald Sterling say that, I was like, Donald Sterling not say that, I went, is this a racist or is this just an old fucking ignorant guy? Like, to me, there's a difference. You know what I mean? There's a big difference between an ignorant fuck and a racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I went, this guy strikes me as an ignorant fuck, not as some dude who hates blacks. So I told my friend this because we're having this discussion, and my friend goes, well, why don't you even think he's racist? I go, well, first of all, he's made more black men millionaires than everybody we know put together. That's a fact. And he goes, well, he had to hire blacks, right? Because he's an owner of a basketball team. And right. I said, it's the Clippers. He could have had all whites and sucked just as bad as they sucked. Might have even been a better fucking team than the shit they put out before.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Every great black player they've ever had, they fucking lost back in the day. I mean, these past 2 years, notwithstanding, which, by the way, they still haven't won any fucking championships. He could have put a white team and not won championships and still been in the exact same place he is today.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought to myself, and I told my friend this, I go, fuck, I wish I had a time machine, bro. I wish I had a time machine so we could go back in time and bring a black guy from the 1700s and tell him that dude Donald Sterling is a racist, and him ask us why, and when we tell him, him to just... So it's this bit of this black guy going, oh, he treats his niggas like shit. Well, fuck it, he doesn't own any black... He don't own no niggas. No, he a racist. Yeah. But he don't own no niggas. No, he pays him. He pays his niggas. You know what I mean? Millions. He pays his niggas. You know, do he tell niggas what to do? No, he don't tell them what to do. He hires a coach. The coach is actually black. Niggas be telling niggas what to do. You know what I mean? And it's just like, do he hang out with niggas? Hang out. He fucks one. He fucks one. Yeah, she's half black and half Mexican. What the fuck? Half what? You know, half Mexican. He's like, what's that? Oh, Mexicans are like the new niggas. Yo, got new niggas? Yeah, because the old ones quit. Niggas quit. Yeah, what are we, you know, what do niggas do in the future? Oh, look at the president. Oh, shit. You know, to him, it was just this buildup of this shit, great fucking bit. And the irony of all my stuff is ever since 1994, I have every joke that I've ever written the day I wrote it.
Because you record every
show. Because I record every show. So, I could tell you what day I wrote that joke, and it'll be literally 1 week after the Donald Sterling stuff. It was on stage in this form already.
Mm-hmm. In that form?
In that form already. Because it just, like, they're literally, he'll tell you, the essence of the joke is always there for me. It's the tags and the little things that change
the
around
nuances,
it. But the actual premise itself is just always boom. You
just
know
forms
I mean?
In your brain super quick.
Yeah, it's how to present it that gets, you know, like really, not tricky, but it's the part.
What percentage do you think of stand-up is, delivery?
Different
versus,
for everybody.
Yeah, for sure.
And different for every single person.
What you told me is it took you 10 years to build the Carlos Mencia joke machine.
Right.
To where 10 years of doing stand-up, you're just figuring out the parts, figuring out the components, and then now you can drop a topic, i.e.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, Sterling... Whatever's going on in the news.
Doesn't matter.
You drop it into the Carlos Mencia joke machine, and out pops a Carlos Mencia joke.
Yeah.
And now you know how that machine works.
Right.
So it's just understanding what your machine is, how what your perspective is, and how your take is going to be on that premise.
Yeah, whatever that premise is. It's just it's that simple. You know what I mean? Like a buddy of mine asked me recently what side I'm on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And... I immediately went, okay, you know what? There's a joke. Because first of all, why are we fighting over supposed gods? Which, mm-hmm. in my opinion, if your god needs your help to accomplish it, you must have a punk ass weak god. Because my god is the shit. My god doesn't need me for anything.
Yeah.
My god has never asked me for anything. My god has never said, like, hey, go kill somebody. You busy? What the fuck you got to do? Like, why do I gotta get a visa? I gotta get a passport. I gotta fly. I gotta make money. Dude, those are breadcrumbs. I've seen CSI. They're gonna catch me, dude. Your god, you could just be like, heart attack, boom, done. Like, do your thing. You know what I mean? So then I'm like, okay, why don't they fight it out? Why don't all the gods fight it out? You know what I mean? And so there, I know that that's going to be funny.
Yeah.
So then here's where it gets tricky. How many gods am I going to have fight, right? There's the top four, right, which is Allah, Buddha, you know, Christ, the God, the God of Jehovah.
Oprah.
Which is kind of Oprah. You know what I mean? And then do I want to put, all right, there's 2,000 Hindu gods. So, okay, I got to figure that one out. And then do I want to put, you know, the Scientology stuff in there or not? Mm-hmm. So I go with the top five. So then in my head, I go automatically, who's going to win that fight? All right, it's obviously got to be Shiva, right? The blue god of the Hindu order who has 8 fucking arms. If he loses a fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who the fuck? He's got 8 fucking arms, for Christ's sake.
My first 3 arms.
Right? Yeah. He's the boss from the original Mortal Kombat game.
You except know? Yeah, he only had 4.
Oh, shit. So
right? This
8.
Dude has 8. So he could block with 4, punch with 2, jerk off with 1, and play with his butt. Like, he literally can, like, literally. Yeah,
that's the ultimate arms. Thing. If you're getting your ass kicked by a guy who's also fingering his own ass.
And jerking off. So, okay, so now I work backwards. So, okay, so I'm a Christian. Of course. Christ had turned the other cheek. So he's not winning any fucking fights. Dude's in sandals, for Christ's sakes. Yeah. Like, I'm going to be like, what happened, Jesus? He's going to be like, dude, he hit me. I turned the other cheek. He knocked me the fuck out. All right. Yeah. So there's a loser automatically. Now, Buddha's overweight. Okay, there's a joke. Now, how do I make that funny? Do I say he's an overweight guy who's not going to... Do I do an impression of him saying, holy shit?
Right.
And so I was on stage and I went, I'm going to do an impression of him. So I'm doing the Jesus bit while I'm thinking of what's Buddha going to say. Mm-hmm. So then I get to Buddha, and Buddha, so then it just became, oh, holy shit, I did not realize how fucking out of shape I am. Holy shit, today's cookies would not have no fortune. All right, so I know that's going to kill. And then, you know what I mean? And then so it's built like that, but it is literally built. I just think of the shell when I'm off stage. Right, I think of the shell, and then when I'm on stage, I add all the salt, the pepper, I'm that guy that while I'm cooking, you know what I mean? I'm to comedy in my head, the way I operate, what Chopped is a TV version of Cooks. I'm that.
Yeah.
You tell me what the fuck I got, and then I'll cook you some shit. And that's every single night is exactly that.
Today's secret ingredient is Mexican impressions.
Exactly.
I got that.
Exactly.
I'll make you a breakfast burrito. Right.
So, you know, so then I go, okay, I got to do an impression of a Japanese guy, even though he's kind of Chinese, he's kind of Japanese, but I don't want to go bull, so I can't go, but I got a little bit. Kind of rasp in the middle. And that's kind of how it works. But luckily, I know that Shiva is the blue god. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I have enough knowledge. Retention in history in America.
I was going to ask because
that's very important.
Your thirst
without
for knowledge,
it, you can't.
And, you can't. I mean, do you feel like you can't be even a good comic without knowing, without just being? I mean, obviously we're all observational and we're learning about the world, but like, I mean, do you need to read the news? Do you need to be up to date and current with everything?
The genius of comedy is this, and this is my opinion. I think that a lot of comics, especially the younger generation of comics, think that writing a joke that is so smart is brilliant. And to me, that's not the genius of comedy. The genius of comedy is to take something that is brilliant, that the majority of people wouldn't understand, and simplifying it just enough so that the average person can actually savor what it is that you're talking about. Because if you're a really, really funny guy and you just do your act and that's the thing that you do and you allow people to gravitate toward you, then that's cool. That's the choice that you make. I'm different. You know, this weekend I was in Mississippi And my opening act, Cisco, looks out into the audience, and we got a sold-out show at this theater, and it's a nice big-size venue, but literally it was fathers of late 40s, early 50s, bringing their recently 21 to 23-year-old kids to see me perform. Because
pretty
back
big age range.
Back when they grew up listening to me, but their kids watched me when they were really young on Mina Mencia.
Yeah. Wow.
So bringing those generations together, you know what I mean? In the South, in Mississippi, which is like a different place.
Yeah.
And so I got off stage the first show and I was like, by the way, was I fucking twanging or something when I was up there? And Cisco was like, yeah, dude, you sounded like you're from here. Kinda. You sounded like you grew up here and then left and then learned how to speak the way the way normal people in America do and then came back and just gave them enough twang to let them know, like, you're from here. I didn't do it on purpose, by the way.
Your Chinese Buddha was chewing tobacco and spitting out of a straw?
Exactly. And so he was just like, wow. And I was blown away because, like, I forgot that I do that. I forgot that I make people feel really, really comfortable when I'm on stage.
And some people do that when they have a conversation because they pick up on the note that the other person is saying when they're talking. You did it all on your own. You did it like, I'm just going to go up on stage and...
Except...
The laughs, maybe?
No, I did exactly what you said. Remember earlier that I said... I remember earlier I said, I treat audiences like they're individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say it's like you're talking to an individual, that's exactly it. And I was talking to an individual, majority people from the South, who kind of understood that. And so it kind of went to that place. The jokes never changed the premises. I might be a little more aggressive or less aggressive. Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean? Less profanity, more profanity, whatever that is. But the essence of whatever the thing I'm making fun of is, that always remains the same. And I never back off on that.
I feel like it's got to be a little overwhelming being you because I think you're so genuinely like curious and engaged by, like, just even with conversation, I feel like the way you're saying that you something hits you and goes, oh, that's a bit.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe you just like are so have such a relaxed mind that you just. But I feel like everything that's happening around you, you're probably could be writing a bit about, and like, doesn't that ever like, or does it just happen?
No, but
but that's the best, right? Or is it?
It's the best and it's the worst because it's never off.
Do you so? And to that point, can you like be at like a friend's barbecue and not be thinking like if he does something funny, you're like, oh, that's a joke, or can you like do you hold yourself back from being present and just like, man, you know, I'm gonna turn my comedy brain off today.
Yeah, can't. The only time it can turn off is if I'm playing a video game where I'm just completely immersed into it.
Yeah.
When I veg out and watch television, you know, I can because I know, like, I like watching dramas because I know where it's going.
Franklin and Bash?
You know what? Like, I watch Franklin and Bash, but they try to be funny. And once you try to be funny, it's really...
Takes the stakes away.
It's really difficult. Yeah. Because then I see the jokes coming. And once that happens, like, I'm able to watch young comics and turn that part off.
Yeah.
But once I hear something and I go, how could you just say that and not add all these things to it?
Oh, man.
It's done. I can't. I have to. That's at that moment,
that's
it's
me with
just
Brad all
too simplistic.
Yeah.
Because it's easy. It's so predictable. You know what I mean? It gets to that point. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll be there with Brad in 5 years if he's still doing midget jokes. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, not in a bad way, but I would just...
I think you have to be because
more.
There's new scenarios that you're constantly getting introduced to in life that, right, that are...
Yeah. I mean, and here's the thing that you always told me, which I will always remember when I was kind of getting frustrated because I was getting some heat from some other comics telling me, like, oh, you're only funny because you're a midget. You know, if you go on stage and not tell any midget jokes, don't even mention it, blah, blah, blah. And you said, Brad, that's stupid because you are a little person. That's who you are. Everything that you see in the world is through the filter of a little person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's impossible for you not to have the perspective of a little person because that is who you are. That's like telling everyone else just to turn off every filter that they have as a human being. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. Like, I don't know how to not write a joke that has, like, that doesn't have dwarf perspective, because that's the only perspective I know.
And that's the only perspective you'll ever know.
If you don't host a like a Nightline type show called Dwarf Perspective in the next 5 years, I'm going to be really upset.
Well, because and remember, we did that bit on Mind of Mencia. I think it got cut where it was like, and now the little people, perspective.
Yeah,
say that 10 times.
Yeah, it was so hard to do. And now the little people perspective with Brad Williams. And I say something really fast, and they go, "Farts suck." And that was the little people perspective with Brad Williams.
Yeah, it was the reason why that's I didn't get on was because by the time we came up with the bit,
yeah,
we had already done so many little people jokes that it was almost like it got to the point where I had to tell writers, dude, we can't do a little people joke. If you want Brad in it for a different reason, that's cool, but it can't. Like, I mean, I remember when we did I was thinking about this the other day when we did Deaf Poetry Slam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And everybody came out, and my favorite one was the letter V. That was fucking genius, bro.
That was your brother Joseph.
Yeah,
who cannot pronounce the letter V. He cannot do it for the life of him.
He says B. So we did a poem where he said, "Damn you, letter B," because he can't say V, and then
I cannot describe my friend Victor who drives a Volvo.
Right. It was like, and then I couldn't say video, and then they got rid of videos, and I was so happy, but then they replaced them with DVDs. It was just like,
oh, shit. That's so much passion behind it.
Yeah, and then he comes out, and there's a podium right in front of Brad, and he walks right up to the podium, completely disappears, and then you see two little arms kind of come out the sides of the podium, and you just hear, "I hate podiums," and then he walks off stage. It was like, and so we did so many jokes like that.
Yeah.
Those to me were funny. They weren't overt.
Yeah.
They weren't like, you know.
Yeah, they weren't like, let's say,
and basic.
10 minutes on this. You
right.
know, it was just something fun.
Yeah.
And I know I've already thanked you, but I can't thank you enough for that whole experience, because just being I got in with you right as you got the TV show.
Right.
And you got the TV show, and you're like, well, I have a TV show, and I have a midget in my posse. Obviously, I'm going to put the midget on the TV show.
Well, it just worked out that way, though. It's just like Joseph. Joseph ended up on the TV show because we did this bit on an illegal alien basically trying to teach Americans how to speak broken English to get jobs, because they all have jobs, and the only people that were complaining about not having jobs were Americans. So it was like, how to speak English like a wetback so you can get good jobs. Mm-hmm. And we just had a bunch of people come in and read for it, and we couldn't figure it out. And they were like, "I don't know what you're looking for." And I said, "Here's what I'm looking for." And I said, "Joseph, come here." And I literally gave him the script, and I go, "Just read it." And he just read it, and he was just like, "Listen, if you don't have a job," and we're all dying. And then I never said this. Morty said, one of the EPs said,
Robert Morton,
"Why doesn't he do it?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Okay, I just didn't want to be the one that brought in my brother to do some shit."
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it was born. And I had a lot of, we put a lot of comedians on that show and tried to help them out.
Yeah.
I mean, we did that with Brian Holtzman, just as an angry white guy. That's awesome. Know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was only one guy I didn't put on the show. And I won't say his name because I don't want to create, I need no controversy or bullshit anymore. Like, the one thing that I am very, very prideful of is that you can go online and you can read of dozens, if not hundreds, of comics saying negative things about me. You won't find one of me saying shit about anybody else. That's the one thing I pride myself on. I don't want to be that illegal alien that crossed the border because he pointed out that there was a group of fuckers to the left. Do you know what I'm saying? I just didn't grow up that way. I grew up in the projects where we fucked with each other and we were mean to each other and we made fun of each other and we beat the shit out of each other. But at the end of the day, we had each other's backs. You know
family,
what I mean?
Yeah.
That dude punched me in the face one time and broke my nose. You know what else he did? He jumped in front of me when they were doing a drive-by, and he almost took a bullet from me. So that's how I grew up. And I just I won't go to that place. I never have gone to that place. And so I look at all of this stuff, and I'm happy that I've had the career that I had. But I know, and this kind of sucks, but it's cool. I'm cool with it now. That when I die is when a lot of this positive stuff is going to come out. When I die, it's when all the young guys and women that I helped become, something of a fixture in stand-up are going to say, like, hey, you know what, man? He did this, that for me. He did that for me. But until then, I don't think it's going to be the case. But that's okay, because I didn't do it for that. I'm glad to see, you know, I'm glad to see that Brad has become a guy who could say no to a six-figure job.
Right.
Because he wants to do a different choice in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I met Brad, his choice was, I don't know if I want to do comedy as much, because then I can't go to class. And if I don't go to class, my parents aren't going to pay for school. And if they don't pay for school, then what the fuck am I going to do? And yeah. I saw Brad go from there to, I'm quitting, Dad. I'm not going to school anymore, because there's no point in me getting a degree of some shit that I'm never going to do. And his parents pissed at him, and then him buying a house, and his parents going, okay, all right, you proved us wrong.
Okay,
you're okay, you're buying a house, you're doing yeah. well, and your sister's living with you.
Yeah.
Good for you. So I saw that whole transformation, and I'm proud of the fact that I did that. And there are a bunch of names that I could throw out there that I don't, because it's just not where I come from anymore. Well, it never was part of it, right? It never was like that.
Never was.
Well, Brad is one of my best friends and one of the funniest dudes I know. So
me
I personally
too.
Need to thank you for setting him on the path to doing what he
is. I just accelerated
it.
That's all I ever did.
Because had he not done that, we wouldn't have met. We wouldn't have done this podcast, and I would have had fucking porn shoot flashbacks when I pulled up about an hour ago.
Well, just so you know, I have never, ever, 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 you know, had existed in that part of his life. Believe it or not, as long as I've known Brad,
all right,
that's
well, let's,
never.
Let's end this
part
podcast, because I guarantee they're still filming.
Okay, so
bro, just so you know, next door, they're doing yeah,
two blocks away. Is Immoral Productions. We can head down there right now. Okay, and I think Brittany Amber's doing a scene.
Oh,
so
just so you
there.
Know, dude, they've asked me to use this to use the green drop pack there, because
right.
the green screen, because they want to do some crazy stuff.
What? Because they want to bone in 1920s London?
Yeah, they wanted
hey,
to do some green
say
screen.
Don't so much hostility.
They did, and I was almost gonna let them do it, but then.
They call me Jack the Ripper because my cock rips you in half.
Sweet yeah. Jesus, how much is that soundbite?
Wow. Oh my God, are you going to stab me with that knife? If you want to call it a knife, yeah, it's a little fatter than a knife.
Put your Mary Poppins in my Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, exactly.
How we could talk to you forever. I really appreciate you doing this.
Not a problem, man.
This has been really awesome.
And thank you not only for what you did for me, but for what you've done for a lot of comics.
No shit.
And if they say if they save their thank yous for after you've gone on to this,
it'll happen. What do you
next
think?
Life? I think it will. So I'm
when
saying
I die,
it,
right?
Yeah.
When I
so
die.
So I'm saying it yeah. on behalf of them now.
No,
is,
you don't have to, brother.
Thank you.
No, but I you know, like I never did it for that. So it's never been a part of my. But at the bottom line is, I believe that as a comedian, I've been very, very misunderstood, because I think that I heard something the other day in ending this. There was a woman on entertainment television who, during the red carpet of the Oscars, said that an actress who walked up smelled like weed and patchouli oil. Some people got offended, and the next day she apologized. And in her apology, she said, I didn't intend to hurt anybody's feelings, but intent doesn't matter because I did, and I'm sorry. And I'm not of that school.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went on stage and comics were bombing, and I went up on stage and said, how many minutes? And these guys yelled out 5 or 6 or 7. Yeah, part of it was a young guy, you know, feeding an ego. But the biggest part of it was me trying to say to the other comics, like, you can do this. And remember who we're here for them. For these audience, for these 15 people that yeah. don't have to be here, they shouldn't be abused. Give them a show. Put it out there. This is what we live by. Because a lot of people want to do comedy to do a TV show, but they forget. You still need viewers.
Mm-hmm.
You still need fans.
Yeah.
Those fans have
That's
to follow you to where it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And if you don't synergize them, you don't maximize this stuff. There are very, very few comics who have been able to do what Steve Martin did, you know, to kill on TV, kill in movies, and kill in appearances.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of comics kick ass on TV, don't do good road work.
Yep.
A lot of comics kill it on the road, don't do good TV or movies, you know. And so there's very few guys that have the trajectory of like Kevin Hart right now. And when you get that, you know what I mean? You should understand it's because he was good to his fans on every level, every night, every show, no matter what. He didn't shit on them. He didn't fuck them over. He treated every single show for what it was. The last opportunity for you to go on stage and preach your word, whatever the fuck that is, whatever your view is, whatever your thing is, whatever your angle is, give it to them to the best of your ability. Every single show, every single night, no matter who's there, who's not, wherever you are. And if you do that, then you're paying respect to your art, but also to the people that are there for you. I've never understood comics that shit on crowds. Oh, they're stupid. Yeah. They're here. They're fucking here to see you. Yeah.
With all the other entertainment.
With everything. With everything there is, they're here to see you. And one minute, it's like, man, fuck this crowd. They suck. And the next minute, it's like, man, there's just not enough comedy clubs. You're closing down left and right. Mm-hmm. Well, with your fucking attitude, of course they're going
to
close.
Yeah. Who wants to come see Bad Attitude Night?
Yeah, and it happens way too much.
So if you want to see a guy that's good, that's going to give you his absolute all, rather than me do a 2-hour show or just fucking kill like it's the last time he's ever going to be on stage.
It's either going to be a 2-hour show or an hour and 10-minute show with 2 hours of material sped up into some intense. I mean, if you watch him, that's where he got that speed from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He got the volume and the speed.
Oh, yeah.
And that from watching me. That's why he is so different off stage. Like in this, even in this podcast, you could tell that when I start talking, I speed up a little bit. There's an amp. I'm excited.
Yeah.
He's not doing that right now.
Yeah.
Because, but watch him on stage.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it's so like Carlos. I remember. As a matter of fact, the last time you went up on stage, Burr was watching you, going, "Man, he learned a lot from you, huh, bro?" He was. It was a little dicky, by the way he said it. You know what I mean? It wasn't a full on compliment. It was more like, "Oh, I wonder where he got that from." But I thought it was awesome. We're all influenced by somebody, as am I influenced by everybody else. Yep. So it's awesome, man. Yeah. But everybody out there, keep doing what you're doing. So, rock on.
Yeah. Tour dates. Where can people? I mean, just Carlos Mencia.
Just go to Carlos Mencia. com or go to Carlos Mencia, Facebook.com/CarlosMencia.com. Click on schedule. It's all there. So I'm going to be in Brea. I don't know. When is this podcast airing?
Yeah. Next Monday.
So next Monday, I think I'm going to be in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
At Tempe, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So there's the Phoenix stand-up live. I'm going to be at the Improv in Tempe. So it'll be fun.
Say hi to Dan Marley for me.
I will. I don't know if I'll see him because I don't know where
he owns a restaurant, I think, nearby the.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll go check that out.
Called Marley's,
sure.
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Well, there you go.
Awesome.
They've got great tacos. We're not sponsored by Marley's yet, but every podcast.
We'll
trying to get another NBA player restaurant.
It'll happen.
Awesome.
Ned, thank you so much for doing this.
Welcome.
Man.
Thanks, buddy.
Show! That's the show! Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.